On this edition of Political Rewind, we look at politics and the Super Bowl. The lieutenant governor flexes his muscle and declares out with the old, in with the new. Controversy bubbles up as the legislature looks at buying new voting machines. And a Georgia congressman scolds the FBI for its treatment of Roger Stone. Political Rewind starts right now. Well, we're glad to have you with us for this edition of Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. It's Super Bowl time in Atlanta, Georgia. We're going to talk a little bit about the Super Bowl and politics with our panel today. We start with our lead political writer, the AJC's lead political writer, Jim Galloway. You read him in the Wednesday and Sunday editions of the paper, and he also oversees the Political Insider blog, which all day, every day is updating political stories. My AJC.com will get you there.
Yeah.
Right? You have tickets to the game, don't you?
In front of my television set. Yes, I do.
Like a lot of us. Amy Steigerwald, political science professor at Georgia State University, is back with us. Hello, Amy. How are you?
Good. How are you today?
I'm terrific. And I know you looked at tickets to the game and saw.
We did. And they're very expensive.
Stacey Evans, former state representative, is with us today. You ran in the primary against Stacey Abrams. Mm-hmm. We're going to talk a little bit about the way your former opponent's star has just risen and risen since the election. And we'll get to that in a little while. Thanks for being here.
Thanks for having me.
We also have Loretta Lepore on Fridays with us. Loretta was Sonny Perdue's press secretary when Sonny was governor of Georgia, and now does consulting work. And again, I always like to say public policy is really the area increasingly that you focus on rather than campaign-oriented issues.
Yes. I'm turning into a little bit of a policy nerd.
A wonk.
A wonk. Okay, wonk sound. I don't know which sounds better, but yeah, that's where I like to spend my time.
All right. Galloway, let me start with a big question that people have been asking. Is the NFL going to require Mercedes-Benz Stadium to have the roof open or closed on Sunday?
You know, I don't know yet. I don't think they know yet.
They've been talking about that for about 4 or 5 days now. I know that in some ways they kind of want to show off that that roof marvel.
I think the weather's going to be fine for an open roof game.
Yeah. Well, we'll see about that. One thing that's not going to be open is a $27 million bridge paid for primarily by the state, but which your reporters at the AJC say the city of Atlanta overpaid some $2 million for a function that is, they don't know what it's all about.
Right,
yet.
Right. Mayor Keisha Lance Bottoms is disputing the price, but I'll go with our people on that one. But it looks it's going to be open. It's going to be open for the Super Bowl elite, media and people with passes. The hoi polloi are going to have to cross the street.
Yeah, the bridge was created so that people could get, if they claimed, from Vine City to the other side of Northside Drive. So it spans Northside Drive. The only reason it's worth mentioning, I think, in some ways today, Amy, is, you know, the AJC contacted Mayor Bottoms about this, said, where did this $2 million bill come from out of nowhere? Mm-hmm. And she wouldn't talk about it until they pressed the issue. And it strikes me that there are aspects of her first year in office where people are saying transparent or not transparent, responsive to concerns right away. What do you say about that?
I think it's a difficult thing for anyone in office, especially when they first come in. And she's come in at a time also where there were sort of these last and lingering and remaining issues about transparency, about ethics that she's having to deal with. Because a lot of times there's a lot to oversee. There's a lot of things that you have to look at and be able to take a thing. And I think it's a fair criticism to say, well, where is this money coming from? Right? Why is it being spent? What is leading to it? It can also be difficult when you're the person having to answer the question. You can speak better to this than I can. Of sometimes you're not sure what the answer is, yeah, and you're having to find out yourself, and that can be difficult. But I think she's had to walk a sort of fine line of making sure that she's giving the information that is necessary, but also, particularly at this moment, wanting to still present the city of Atlanta in a good light, because saying that all of a sudden you got to spend a ton of money right before the Super Bowl is a problem.
The city auditor says that there was this $2 million bill that nobody's quite sure what it went for. And I don't want to overemphasize this, Loretta, but I do think it's interesting because it makes us think, as Amy says, about the responsibility of an elected official to know everything. And if he or she doesn't, they find themselves behind the eight ball.
Right. Well, I mean, I think she deserves credit on the one hand for creating the website where all of the city's expenditures
are now present.
So, so she deserves credit for that. The $2 million, somebody ought to be able to speak to that very clearly, because somebody ought to be monitoring those dollars as they were being used and deployed. And if they are a mistake, then somebody ought to know that that's a mistake in reporting on the website as well. I think with respect to her pause in responding about the bridge being open or not being open, I'm sure that was just some of being new and her team going through the first major event here in the city under her leadership. And clearly, when you have an event of this scope, you're dealing with all kinds of authorities that you're not used to dealing with. So she may be dealing with the Atlanta Police Department on a daily basis or even state entities, but you've got some federal entities in here on the ground, and they're making determinations about security and what can and can't be opened. And so I think she may have been attempting to be judicious in how she responded about that. Mm-hmm. But when you are a public official, you have to have some answer.
Yeah. We do know that the feds are the reason the bridge isn't going to be open for security reasons. She was a supporter of yours during the primary campaign, but Stacey Evans, she, like any new elected official in a new job, it still continues to sort of find her footing, doesn't she?
Well, I think she's unfortunately dealing with, as was mentioned, the baggage left over from the last administration, and so I think we can't be surprised that maybe she's less than willing sometimes to give press interviews, because she's being viewed in a light that's not hers sometimes, and that's a little unfair, and I think she realizes that. I would say, though, on this particular situation, there's so much good news to talk about around the Super Bowl, and whatever she talks about publicly is what the news is going to be.
Yeah.
So she wants to talk about things that are going right.
That makes sense.
She doesn't want to talk about the things that are going wrong. She doesn't want that to be the story.
And I will say that I've heard her do a number of national interviews in the last couple of days, and she's represented the city, in my opinion, really quite well.
Yeah. I think she's doing fine.
Okay.
What I found surprising in that article was that the MARTA station is still shows Georgia Dome. That's what I was most surprised about. So how did Mercedes has got to be a little bit upset about that?
I would think so. Oh my gosh.
Branding and advertising that they're missing out.
Yeah, couldn't Arthur Blank or Mercedes pay a little bit more money for a new sign, Jim?
Well, MARTA is very judicious with its spending. Bobby Nash will tell you that.
Yeah, he sure will. The chairman of the MARTA.
Saving money.
On to other matters about the Super Bowl. Jim Galloway, we already know that Stacey Abrams is raising her profile to a new height because she'll do the response to the State of the Union speech next Tuesday. We'll talk about that in a minute. In the meantime, we're going to see her here in Georgia in a Super Bowl ad on Sunday night.
Right. $100,000 air buy for a statewide exposure, and the issue will be voting.
And accurate
and machines.
Yeah.
And this is what we're seeing is this is new for us. This is a new form of politics that we're experiencing in and around the state capitol right now. Because Democrats, led by Abrams, but also very well coordinated in the Senate Democratic and House Democratic caucuses, they are working around kind of the Republican messaging on the voting machines to a big extent.
If you don't mind, let's park that just for a minute, because we're going to dig into that in a much deeper way in a couple minutes. But before we do that, here's the Super Bowl spot that Stacey Abrams will appear in on during the game in Georgia media markets.
Smile.
I'm Republican Natalie Crawford, County Commissioner in North Georgia.
And I'm Democrat Stacey Abrams from Atlanta.
We don't agree on everything,
but we love Georgia
and want fair elections.
Every vote should be counted from every corner of our state.
We need hand-marked paper ballots and our election officials to have the support they need.
Join us in the fight for election reform. Take a selfie and share your support.
Use hashtag Fair Elections Now,
because picturing fair elections is something we can all do.
Loretta, one of the things that's interesting about that spot is Natalie Crawford is a Republican.
Right.
Which is why she says, we don't agree on everything. But there she is with Stacey Abrams in a commercial that essentially says, we better do better in the way elections are run, as opposed to, without saying it, the way the one that she, Stacey Abrams, was in 2018.
Right. So, as we like to say in politics, sometimes issues create strange bedfellows. And in this instance, these two individuals have aligned on a particular issue around voting rights. And in Habersham County, they had some difficulty with ballots cast in one of their races, and they had to redo that election. Natalie's also been a proponent of course, the hand-marked ballots, which Democrats are also advocating for. And so they've come together to do this. I think on a broader level, this is symbolic of what is going on in other places around this bipartisan effort to ensure that Georgia has fair elections moving forward, that they're fair and transparent elections, and that doesn't have to be aligned with one party or the other, but that both parties can work together to ensure that that as we move forward, may not have been so pretty last November, but moving forward, that our system has one that is filled with integrity and people can trust the outcome.
Yeah.
I think it also highlights the fact that, sort of as Loretta was noting, on a lot of these issues, they cut across bipartisanship, right? It's not a single party, the idea that we want to count all of the ballots to make sure that our interests are reflected accurately really has nothing to do with either of the parties. And I think it really sort of showcases that and these kind of broader issues as it's going on. And I think it's also particularly interesting that they're highlighting the idea of a paper ballot, right? The idea that in many ways, right, it's unhackable, that yes, there are these advances in technology, but sometimes, at least in their argument, really simple paper and pencil can work quite well.
Yeah, as I said, I want to move into that in a minute, but Jim, did you want to weigh in? Because I want to ask a question about the commercial itself.
Yes,
go ahead.
But what I have to, that commercial that we've just seen, it's not about Stacey Abrams running for U.S. Senate.
Right.
It's about an issue that's on the floor of the legislature right now.
Exactly.
It is there to persuade Republican lawmakers to back away from this SAFE Commission proposal for optical scan, or I'm sorry, for touchscreen voting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. All right. Let's talk about that then. But before we do, again, I'm interested. I kept trying to move it down, but you know what? It's obviously a good thing to talk about now. But before we do, Stacey Evans, I think the tone of that spot is great, isn't it?
It's fantastic.
Very upbeat. They're doing a selfie. You know, it's kind of this whole new approach to how elected officials, politicians are communicating with their constituents, their friends, their supporters out there.
It's a great ad. You have two women. They look great. They look comfortable. They're smiling. They're happy. I think it's a great ad for Stacey Abrams, for not only her personally, how she comes across as very personable and relatable in that ad. Shows her working with a Republican, which is something that people want to see. It's also good for the Republicans to have someone in that ad who is saying, not like Mitch McConnell, that it's a bad idea when people get the day off to vote.
Yeah.
But we want people to vote, and we want those votes to be counted. I think that's a good thing for a democracy. So kudos all around. Great ad.
All right, Galloway, let's do it. The the SAFE Commission was appointed by then Secretary of State Brian Kemp to explore new systems for voting, right?
Right.
And what was interesting about it is the commission came back, and a majority of the members of the commission said they want what they call ballot marking machines, which means you vote on a computer, but it generates a paper trail. The Democrats voted against it, and the one cybersecurity expert on the commission, a Georgia Tech professor,
Warren Cooley,
said we ought to go to paper ballots. That sets the stage for where we're at now.
Right. So what you had on Wednesday was, okay, this happened, I think, January 10th, a few weeks ago. They put their report out. On Wednesday, of this last week. The House Democratic Caucus had one of their little, had a meeting, a kind of a dog and pony show on voting machines, and the room was absolutely packed. It was filled with Democrats. There were a few Republicans, and they launched what they call the dissent. A dissenting report.
Democrats want paper ballots that you mark yourself.
Paper ballots, and they described the commission, the way the commission arrived at its decision as vendor driven. Mm-hmm. That it was being driven by the people with a financial stake in the outcome.
So. What's interesting about this, Stacey, because you were down there, mm-hmm. Is to, and Jim points this out in a column that is in the Sunday paper, that for Democrats to generate this kind of attention, a minority party at the state legislature, mm-hmm. a party which either gets rolled over quite frequently by Republican legislators or for reasons, practical reasons, goes along with the majority, they made a big show out of their opposition mm-hmm. and attracted attention. And I don't think they would have attracted, and I think you sort of say this, they wouldn't have attracted Democrats this kind of attention a session ago or two sessions ago. It shows that while they're still in the minority, people are starting to pay attention to Democrats.
It's a new day. There are more Democrats in the legislature than there have been in quite some time. And the public is with the Democratic position on this issue. Period. Folks are very skeptical about these electronic machines. Now, I have a little bit of a nuanced position on this. I think that the process was bad. I absolutely agree with my Democratic colleagues and former colleagues that was a bad process, and it does appear to have been very vendor-driven. And there are certainly reasons for us to be skeptical of the safety of these machines. But if we could get that right, it's really hard to argue that the touchscreen electronic voting is not more clear than a hand-marked paper ballot. And you can look at example after example. You can talk about Bush v. Gore and hanging chads. You can talk about people halfway bubbling to the right instead of bubbling to the left. And then somebody's got to decide what the voter meant. And that's terrifying to me to think about all of these individual counties and someone deciding what someone meant when a touchscreen is very clear. But we've got to take care of that security first. And until we can take care of that security, people are not going to be focusing on those problems with hand marked.
Yeah, ballots. Loretta, you're nodding as Stacey says that.
Well, I am, because the machines are going to be much more clear in what they print out than if individuals are spending time marking with pencils and erasing and remarking. And the way that the system would actually work is that you obviously touch the screen and select your candidates, and then the ballot prints out, you review it, you personally scan it into the system, and then you put it in a box so that if there is a recount, they have two ways to go through a recount in a pretty quick manner. And then you don't get into the voting chat issue where there is subjectivity on what that ballot looks like.
You know, so Amy, I do understand the bubble and whether you fill it in properly. I have always thought this hanging chad Florida Bush v. Gore argument is missing the point in terms of that, at least. The problem with the Florida ballot in 2000 was the ballot was drawn poorly. If you recall that ballot, it was not just about whether people punched all the way through. It was the positioning of Bush's name, Gore's name on the ballot that made it even more complicated to figure out. I mean, so part of it is ballot design in addition to the machinery you're using to vote on, isn't it?
Most decidedly. I mean, we've seen this in other elections that were happening as well. Concerns, for example, in one of the Florida races that because of the way that it was listed, that a number of people might have actually missed the U.S. Senate race because of where it was listed in comparison to the rest of the ballot. And so ballot design is a huge thing. I think it's on both sides that there is, number one, this issue of are the initial results going to be protected? And I think getting at the point Stacey was bringing up, that a lot of people are distrustful about the machines. You hear stories coming out about, oh, it changed my vote. And particularly right now, with no record other than what's recorded in the machine, there's no way to go back and check it, right? You don't get to actually see what actually gets recorded. You just see that sort of last page. And so there needs to be some sort of trail there. A separate section is, if, in fact, there's a contested vote and now we're going back to the ballots and we're trying to figure out what they say, then we start to look at these things. And it is definitely true that a lot of the issues that we saw in Bush v. Gore were much more a function of ballot design and also an actual physical system which was difficult to use. That's sort of the other thing. The punch system is a very difficult. It has its own issues. It sort of always has a lot of false negatives.
Jim, you alluded, though, to the to one of the reasons Democrats are a little more exorcised than they might otherwise have been. There's this concern about cronyism. The voting machine that the Not that they recommended a specific company, but the style of voting machine that the Safe Commission recommended is exactly the kind that's produced by a company, ES&S, and their lobbyist
their lobbyist was a fellow named Charles Harper, who is now on Governor Kemp's staff,
deputy chief of staff, I think, right?
Right.
Okay.
And so that's pardon?
So not a shabby position.
No. It's a significant spot, and the history is pretty recent, and I believe there's also a case where the company also named someone who's serving as general counsel for Kemp, Secretary of State David Dove, up to a Las Vegas function, and he is on Kemp's staff as well.
Yeah,
I'd like to address that issue for a minute because I attended some of these Safe Commission meetings and followed it very closely, and this whole idea that it was vendor driven is not accurate. So those meetings, that commission was a bipartisan commission, for one. It was made up of state elected officials, as well as county election officials, as well as technology experts. So not only was it bipartisan, but it had a cross-section of individuals who are intimately familiar with our voting process here in Georgia. And that vote was 13-3. Mm-hmm. Now, after that meeting got underway, the first meeting, they put out an RFQ. The Secretary of State's office put out what's called an RFQ to see what the technology currently is today around voting machines. So a number of companies submitted their solicitations explaining what they did. Some of those vendors came in to present at subsequent meetings about the technology itself, about the machines. No machines have been selected.
Right.
Right? So whatever the legislature decides, however this goes based on the recommendation from the commission and then how much of that they take into account or they take into the minority positions account, and whatever they come out with, then an RFP will be put out to decide who the vendor will be.
I think that's a great explanation. Stacey, what's interesting about what Loretta said is, number one, it is certainly true that there's been no choice yet of a vendor for these machines. For that matter, the legislature hasn't voted to say, yes, we want ballot marking computers, although we assume that's where they're headed. So to raise questions about the connections between ES&S and Governor Kemp's staff, maybe not premature, but not necessarily proof of anything underhanded about what's going on.
Certainly no contracts have been handed out yet, though. You've seen a strong signal in the governor's budget that this is the way they want to go, because they
paying $150 million.
Budgeted for $150 million as opposed to the
$30 million.
But
not necessarily that vendor. There are a number of vendors who produce machines that fit the description, is my understanding.
But they've been so front and center in the discussions and the process that I think, listen, I don't have an initial strong negative reaction to someone when they say they're a lobbyist. I mean, everybody has to make a living, and that's a function. It's a vital function of the process of getting information to legislators, right? You should take it all with a grain of salt when it's coming from a lobbyist, but they are a source of information for legislators. So I don't fault someone for pushing for their position, but I think it was a really sort of an unforced error on Kemp's part to make this appointment. I mean, why do that? He could have avoided this whole discussion.
Jim, I think that's a good point, too. Here's a guy who's now governor of Georgia who certainly wants to get out from under this cloud of the election having not been fairly held, conducted, voter purges, all the problems that were raised during the campaign, his decision not to recuse himself from overseeing the election. This seems like a simple issue to avoid entirely, even if it meant, say, waiting till a while before you appoint if you really want Charlie Harper to be your deputy chief of staff.
But you do have to understand that some of these relationships go back years when Brian Kemp started serving as Secretary of State.
Okay.
And you know, one of the it was true on the Democratic side, but one of the and especially true in the Republican world is that loyalty and relationships matter a whole lot.
Sure. Sure. All right. So we're going to watch how that unfolds. What I find, okay, so here's the irony in the other direction. If, you know, the AJC has done this story a couple times now, we're talking about it. What if ES&S happens to make the absolutely premier machinery for this kind of voting? Is this going to make it very difficult for legislators and the governor to move forward with giving them a contract if there are concerns?
But I do. If I'm not mistaken, they already have a contract with the state. They do maintain Georgia's current crop of voting machines.
Okay, but this is an additional $150 million dollar contract. So
there's concerns. I mean, that's sort of the issue on all of this is that many times, right, perception is more what people know as opposed to the information behind. And it does run that risk. I mean, I think the bigger thing is to be able to have a sort of public debate. And for all the information that Loretta was talking about that has come out of the SAFE Commission to explain to people about what it is that we want in these new voting machines. What we know is they have to have some type of a paper record. What that then is going to look like and what's the best way to do that is something that sort of needs to be debated. And my hope would be that they would listen to, right, the concerns coming from the various county officials, right, including who we just saw on the ad with Stacey Abrams coming out of Habersham County, right, as well as the cybersecurity experts, et cetera, in order to make the sort of best decision there.
All right. Tell you what, let's get a break out of the way and come back and talk about a number of other issues that popped up over the last couple of days. And you know what? Loretta Lepore, I'm so glad you were watching the SAFE Commission because we're going to ask you to keep us up to speed on how these things are unfolding from the insider's point of view. That's why you're a political insider.
Okay. Just for the record, I have no interests in this.
I get
in the discussion.
All right. All right. Let's do this. Let's get a break out of the way. We'll be back in just a minute.
A Seat at the Table is a weekly series hosted by Deneen Milner, Christine White, and Monica Pearson. The mission of A Seat at the Table is to let African-American women have a platform to educate communities about the Black woman's experience, life, and journey.
Today, we're talking about using the N-word.
Is a college education still necessary in today's world?
Today, we're talking about what it means to be woke.
From credit to entrepreneurship, Black women are about our business.
Join us for A Seat at the Table on GPB.
Jim Galloway, President Trump yesterday had a little scrum in the cabinet room, spent most of his time talking again about how the wall has to be part of any kind of deal or else he's going to reject it. But he was also asked about Stacey Abrams. Here's what he said.
Well, I campaigned against Stacey Abrams. I know that President Obama campaigned for her, Michelle Obama campaigned for her, and Oprah campaigned for her. And all Brian had was me. And he won fairly easily, I hope that she does a good job. I mean, I respect her. I don't know her. I haven't met her, but I hope she does a good job.
Jim?
Well,
he hasn't given her a nickname.
A couple corrections here.
Yeah.
Number one, I don't think Michelle Obama ever campaigned for.
Yeah, that's really right.
Barack Obama did, and
Oprah.
So did Oprah. And I think Donald Trump is forgetting that Mike Pence, his vice president, was down here for a couple times.
Yeah.
And I'm sure Governor Kemp would like to say that he had a hand in his own victory.
I would think he might feel that way, Stacey.
Yeah, I think so. He also had a very popular outgoing Republican governor in Governor Deal campaigning for him, and he had that going for him as well. So, yeah, I would definitely think that Governor Kemp would not probably quite agree exactly with what Donald Trump said. And I don't think anyone would say he won quite easily either. I think that was a little bit of a misstatement there on Trump's part.
So just this is sheer speculation. We don't know. We can't get inside the mind of President Trump. But why so easygoing? Why so nice about Stacey Abrams, Amy?
I think he is in... It's hard to know, and this is, of course, gross speculation, but he does
We love that on this show.
He does seem to be recently... at least understanding and much more perceptive about the power of certain female politicians. Uh-huh. A very similar person that doesn't have a nickname so far is Nancy Pelosi.
Yeah, but oh man, he's now going after her once again guns
but
blazing.
As he still said, he refers to her as Nancy. And,
True. You
know, I think a lot of times he's got to refer to her as Madam Speaker. And at the end of the day, in their last little query, that sort of put it off. And so I think some of this is sort of realizing that many of the statements where he's gone after people, it has not necessarily worked well for him. Mm-hmm. And I think it's also that there's not a really good thing for him to hang his hat on when it comes to Stacey Abrams. And he probably does recognize that there's a lot of her voters that he's going to need to bring back into the fold if he wants to, in fact, win Georgia.
Yeah, it also may be, it strikes me, that she hasn't achieved the kind of position in the political universe yet that qualifies her for being attacked by President Trump.
Right? Well, I think some of what Amy alluded to is very accurate. But I know that there's been reporting that Senator Perdue had lunch with the president very recently. And so he may have tempered his comments predicated on what was discussed at that lunch. And, you know, knowing that because he's going to probably, you know, very actively campaign for Senator Perdue at some point, that maybe they're just waiting on that strategy.
Well, if I could jump in here, if you go back to the AJC poll of that came out last month, Perdue's approval rating was, I think, 45%, which is not bad. It was far better than Brian Kemp's, but and he did very, very well in rural Georgia. But Perdue also didn't do bad in suburban metro Atlanta.
No, surprisingly well compared to other Republicans.
And if Trump were to start going after Ms. Abrams in a harsh fashion, that redounds to David Perdue.
Really an interesting point.
Well, and actually just on that real quick, the person who did have much higher than both Perdue and Kemp in the ratings was, in fact, Stacey Abrams. Right.
Stacey Evans, if you don't mind, you ran against Stacey Abrams in the primary. You made you had a strong case for your candidacy, as did she. She beat you, and you very quickly and very graciously endorsed her. Mm-hmm. So I can't help but want to ask, as long as we have you here today, as you watch her ascendancy mm-hmm. in the National Democratic Party, mm-hmm. how do you deal with that personally? Is it are you thrilled for her? Do you feel a little, you know, sense of could have been me? You know, how do you react to that?
I'm happy for her. I think she's really made a great name for herself, and she's putting Georgia in a good light. And so that makes me happy as a proud Georgian and someone named Stacey. I think that's a great thing. But I have to agree with you. I think that lunch may have tempered Trump, because he had gone after Stacey Abrams before. I think he called her unqualified once before, which was such a silly statement mm-hmm. for him to make about her, given her educational credentials, her service credentials, and everything like that. So I think maybe Perdue said, you know, can you just... but we'll see. After she makes her speech, my guess is nobody will be able to stop him from saying whatever he wants to say, and I suspect he'll have some words.
Are you encouraging... would you encourage her to go ahead and make the race against David Perdue?
I would. I mean, I think she's in a great position. She would likely clear this field and not have a primary, which would be a wonderful thing. Her popularity, her name ID, her support, her approval ratings, everything is sky high. And you know, 4 years is a long time. Yeah. So strike while the iron's hot. I would definitely encourage her to do it. And I think giving the State of the Union response, doing this commercial, I think points to her probably leaning that way. But it's a hard choice, I'm sure. When you decided you want to do something, you decided I want to be governor, it's hard to switch to something else. So I can personally understand why she's grappling with it.
So what do you, one of the things we're waiting for, and you may have heard, I certainly haven't, where she's going to do it?
No, we have no details yet.
Yeah?
No details yet. The last word I heard was midweek. They were trying to decide whether it's Atlanta or Washington, whether it's, you know, the small office that Republicans seem to prefer, or like Joe Kennedy in last year was at a plant, had a bunch of workers around him,
had people with him.
You know, I would counsel for simplicity. I would leave the props at home, people or otherwise, and just kind of just you and the camera and some good thoughts.
Anybody else want to weigh in on that?
Oh, I disagree with that so much.
What do you
think?
I'm
sorry to disagree with you, Jim, so strongly, but when you're giving a speech, you need feedback. I think that's why these speeches are often so awkward, because you're just staring at a camera. There's no clapping. There's no smiling. Mm-hmm. There's nothing to engage with. I think having people there, having some sort of reaction that she can play off, will make her a much better presenter.
You're the former press secretary. You ought to be able to weigh in on this one for us.
Well, I think it does speak a lot to the individual. Yeah. What is the individual's style, and how do they best perform in this type of environment? And I think, to Stacey's point, Stacey Abrams has always been a powerful speaker in front of other people. She tends to get some type of energy from the people around her and is able to speak directly to them when she's in a less... You know, when there are less, fewer people around and she's more isolated, she tends to be more reserved. So it really is going to depend on what kind of image and tone she wants to evoke.
Okay. All right. Let's move on. Jim, in passing, because we don't have to talk about it for a long period of time, but as we move to other subjects, we've got word now that Governor Kemp has named a successor to Vernon Keenan, who was with GBI in one capacity or another for more than four decades, 15 as director, in many ways a beloved figure in that agency, and now the governor has picked his successor.
This is one of the prime appointments that a governor can make, and for that very reason, because it's generally an appointment that doesn't expire at the end of a governor's term. It's something that keeps, that you can hold on to for a while. Vic Reynolds is a very popular DA in Cobb. He was one of the first, I think, one of the first few DAs to back Kemp in this contest, and helped him formulate his policy as far as going after gangs in Georgia.
Yeah.
His appointment is really interesting in terms of local Cobb County politics, because this is the district attorney's office, the sheriff's office, and the Cobb Commission chair are all coming open in 2020, mm-hmm. and we know that Cobb is in the last two cycles has pretty much gone blue, mm-hmm. and so it's going to be very interesting to see who Kemp might pick to fill that term in the meantime.
Do you have any observations about Vic Reynolds up your way, Cobb County?
Yeah, I think very highly of Vic. I think this was a good choice by Governor Kemp. I'm excited for my friend Vic Reynolds. I think he'll do a great job. And it opens up some more opportunities for Democrats in Cobb County, which, of course, makes me happy. And certainly the Democratic Party was looking and trying to recruit for – they're trying to recruit for commission chair, for DA, for sheriff, for these races coming up in 2020. And Vic Reynolds would have been a hard Republican to beat for Democrats. I would be the first to admit that.
It will definitely make Democratic recruiting for the DA spot a lot easier.
It'll be much easier.
All right. Well, we're going to watch Vic Reynolds when he steps into that role relatively soon. Jim, Jeff Duncan, the brand new lieutenant governor, has essentially put his foot down. And he has said that there are a number, and I think it's a fairly large number, of people who Governor Deal, who left office as one of the most popular governors the Georgias had in modern times, a number of those appointees, he doesn't want them there. he's going to kick them out and start over again.
Well, what he is saying is what he is saying is that and Amy can give the historical background. My first thought was Marbury versus Madison, and look it up.
We're going to talk about it. But go ahead.
But basically, what happened is Governor Deal, as he was walking out the door, sent the Senate a list of his appointees that he needed them to ratify in order to hold office. I think three of them they include three appointments to the Board of Regents. He sent it to Lieutenant Governor Jeff Duncan before he was sworn in as Lieutenant Governor. And apparently the proper thing to do would have been to send it to the Secretary of State because there was no Lieutenant Governor to send it to. So Duncan has declared that list null and void. We will see what happens next week. Brian Kemp is supposed to give that list, plus whatever appointments he wants, over to the Senate by the 10th day of the session, which will be sometime next week. And we will see whether the list of appointees is vastly different from what Nathan Deal left him or not.
All right. So, first of all, Marbury versus Madison, major early test in the United States Supreme Court, right? It was a result of the presidential battle between John Adams and Thomas Jefferson, right? If I got this right so far, Jefferson won, and after winning, tried to get rid of a bunch of people that Adams had. How did the next step of that work?
There had been put in, so the outgoing president had passed a new bill that added a number of positions, a lot of judgeships, as well as Marbury was going to be a post office master.
Yeah. So this is Marbury versus Madison.
It is Marbury v. Madison, right? That was the exact same thing. The question was whether or not their nominations had been correctly delivered. The person that was supposed to deliver them was the Secretary of State. The Secretary of State had... in the interim, been nominated to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, or Chief Justice of the United States, who was, of course, the head of the Supreme Court. And so that led to sort of an interesting case, the canceling of the Supreme Court for a term, because they didn't want the case to be heard. So that's actually why it was decided in 1803 and not 1802.
Real? Now, that I didn't know. All right, so what is Jeff Duncan? Is Jeff Duncan merely trying to follow a procedure correctly, worrying that perhaps it could be overturned if someone wanted to go to court about these appointments? Or, as the AJC suggests, is he showing his muscles, and is this a power play of some sort?
You know, obviously I don't have that answer, but I will say that Jeff Duncan, the Lieutenant Governor Duncan, is someone who is going to govern by the book. He is going to be a stickler for that type of thing. I think we're seeing indications of that in a lot of different ways. I don't know about the politics of this. I suspect that this list that is going back to the governor and the list that the governor is going to resubmit or submit of his own appointees to open spots will include some of these same folks that are on this list. So, you know, at the end of the day, we kind of just have to see how it washes out.
How do you read this?
I don't know. I'm like Loretta. I don't know what Lieutenant Governor Duncan's motivations are. I will say that if that list that we're talking about is different, vastly different next week, well, then he has done Governor Kemp a favor,
which can
help a lieutenant governor later on.
That was exactly what I was wondering, Stacey. Is he, in fact, acting as an agent on Governor Kemp's behalf and protecting Governor Kemp from this? And this list may show us that.
It may. And if it was a political decision, I think that would be some evidence of that, if you see some vastly different names in those spots. But I think from a good government standpoint, you can make the argument that we need to get this right, because if the Board of Regents, for example, sets a policy and someone is punished under that policy, a student or a university in some way, they would be able to challenge that decision by saying that there were certain people who made votes that could have been consequential that weren't there and weren't supposed to be there. So it could have been political. it could have been good government. It could have been both.
So I think the last word on that may be, Jim, Jeff Duncan has managed to put himself in the headlines on several occasions already, and he's only a couple weeks into his job as lieutenant governor and president of the Senate.
Right. This is only comes a day or so after that he said that he was kind of siding with Brian Kemp on the Netflix tax issue that the House wants in order to fuel the expansion of broadband in rural Georgia. I'm told that the House isn't giving up on that. There's more work to be done.
All right, we're going to talk about that as it moves forward in the legislature. But before we talk about anything else today, we're going to take another break. We'll be right back.
A deal to be made there.
It comes down to the vote.
On this election night, two wins in the biggest races.
You broke your silence.
We move forward.
But then you pay the price. When the smoke clears, you and I against
the world. That's what you told me. This is a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity for me. We ride the highs
and lows. Calls for action after the school shooting in Florida.
It's hard to say what motivated President Trump to threaten to veto this bill.
What do they say about the use of these weapons?
This is wild times. Wild times with big issues.
Coming back to prison is not an option.
All that and more. When the smoke clears.
Welcome back to Political Rewind. Jim Galloway, we talked a little while ago in this show about Democrats trying to show they have a new sense of their own power. Now they've added a number of members to the House, particularly. Bob Trammell, the minority leader, is introducing legislation to overturn one of the more controversial pieces of legislation over the past 5 years, campus carry.
Yeah, the right to carry concealed weaponry in certain places on the campuses of public universities. It is one of those suburban versus rural issues that just breaks very, very hard. It is the reason that shotgun that Brian Kemp used in his primary ad had turned off as many voters, as many Republican voters as it turned on. So it's a will it succeed? I don't think so. Probably not. Not this year, in any case. But is it an issue that you can run on year after year after year and get more and more support? Yeah, it's Trammell has dropped his bill in the House. Sally Harrell, who defeated Fran Miller in November, is dropping a similar bill in the Senate.
Okay, well, it's going to be interesting to watch, Daisy.
It will be, and I agree with Jim that it likely will not pass this year. It's probably not something that the committee chairman and the speaker will allow to make it to the floor. But it will be interesting to watch to see if any Republicans quietly go down to the clerk's office and put their name on it and use it as a campaign issue when they're running for re-election in the suburbs.
Yeah. You had eight Republican senators sign on to including Renee Unnerman, sign on to an ERA
bill. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah.
Three of them, Brandon Beach, John Albers, and P.K. Martin, are in that North Metro swath that went heavily Democratic. And it wouldn't surprise me that they may be thinking about that.
It'd be really smart.
Mm-hmm. But because it breaks on those lines of metro versus urban, many of the Republicans that had signed on or opposed previous campus carry in the past, they're no longer in office, right? So the number count doesn't necessarily change at this point in time.
All right. We'll watch how that unfolds, especially as you point out, an election issue for 2020. Doug Collins. Let's talk about Representative Doug Collins for a couple minutes. He was, along with a number of his colleagues on the Hill in Washington, really disturbed by the way Roger Stone, Amy, was treated when he was arrested by the FBI. Who they did come in with a certain show of force at a pre-dawn raid. And it is certainly true that when you look at the video, which, by the way, is under question too, because how did CNN know that it was unfolding? You know, that's another issue the Doug Collinses and Lindsey Grahams are raising. But I think we can take a look at what do we have what Doug Collins said, I think, about all this? Yeah. Given the fact that the FBI is embroiled in a scandal related to the origins of this investigation, we are perplexed about why the FBI would use such a show of force in the arrest of an elderly man. Well, I resent the end of that.
That's 66 years old.
I have to know, Roger Stone also would be really quite bothered by the idea that he is an elderly man. But I think the other side of it is that, number one, it is important to remember that Roger Stone, in part, is being arrested on charges of witness tampering and evidence destruction. And so that, quote-unquote, sort of show of force was really to prevent him from destroying evidence. Second, Roger Stone afterward said that he was treated quite courteously by the FBI and certainly didn't appear to be bothered by it.
Well, he also, though, Loretta, he said a couple of contradictory things. Right. He also made a statement in his black beret and dark sunglasses that they treated him worse than if they it was a Gestapo raid, essentially. So he's kind of gone both ways on that.
Right. He was a little worried about his wife.
Yes, and his dog.
And his dog, right. and what was happening. I think, you know, in these instances, the FBI uses different tactics in different situations, obviously. And, you know, when we saw in the past, Rudy Giuliani was famous for this, for the perp walk, when he was prosecutor in New York. And it was, and when asked about why he did that, why did he walk these white-collar criminals out in handcuffs in the middle of the New York press and create such a scene? And he said, it's the best way to create a deterrent. And so I can't say that this is what happened in this situation, but clearly there are a lot of different messages and signals being sent, not only in this, but through a lot of the efforts that are transpiring with this investigation.
A couple things here. Number one, I think it's good that Republicans are kind of focusing on law enforcement use of force. I think that that resonates with a lot of people in the U.S. You know,
well, not especially with the Super Bowl and Kaepernick and the issues.
Exactly.
That he was
exactly. The second thing I would say is the good news for Doug Collins is that he's got a new position as the ranking Republican on the House Judiciary Committee. The bad news for Doug Collins is that makes him a chief defense attorney for Donald Trump, and he'll have to serve in that role pretty much through the aftermath of whatever Robert Mueller comes out.
You know what? That's such a great point, because this is the beginning of that defense, that he chooses to join, again, the Lindsey Grahams and a few others critical of how the arrest of Roger Stone came down. And it's the beginning of what I think we're going to see. Mm-hmm. I mean, he may become as close to Donald Trump as David Perdue in terms of defending him left and right.
Which would be really disappointing. And I think this move to me was very disappointing because, yes, the issue of police brutality is real. But I haven't ever seen Doug Collins or Lindsey Graham or anybody else come out and talk about how people of color are treated when they are arrested for much smaller crimes than what we're talking about potentially with Roger Stone. And that seems a little it's just really sad to see. I will say I served a little bit of time with Doug Collins in my first term right before he left to go to Congress. And at least he had been involved in some of the criminal justice reform packages that Deal put forward. And so he's not quite as hypocritical as I see some of the others that have come out and talked about this Roger Stone situation. But this is not the poster boy for police brutality. Mr. Roger Stone is not him.
All right. Jim Galloway, we are really short on time, but I want you to know about this if you haven't seen it. As we were sitting here, Politico pushed out a story that will mean a lot to you. Sam Nunn, a byline story, and his concern about the Trump administration saying they are going to undo the nuclear treaty with Russia. Sam Nunn's entire career after leaving the U.S. Senate has been to eliminate nuclear weapons.
And his point is that the U.S. and Russia are stumbling toward a crisis.
Yeah.
This is all about the U.S. announcement that the U.S. is going to withdraw from the medium-range nuclear missile treaty.
The lead of Sam Nunn's piece, and he's been a guest talking about this on Rewind with us, Jim, Friday morning's announcement by Secretary of State Mike Pompeo that America will withdraw from the INF treaty because of Russian violations is the latest wake-up call that relations between the world's nuclear superpowers are dangerously off the rails. There's no question that Sam Nunn will be speaking out on this a lot in the days and weeks ahead, right?
I'll be giving him a phone call.
I wanted to give you a heads up. We are completely out of time for today's show. Jim Galloway, you'll be back with me at 2 o'clock on our Monday show when we're going to talk a little bit more in more detail about what we think might happen on the State of the Union address on Tuesday night. I'm looking forward to that. Stacey Evans, thank you so much for being here. Loretta Lepore, Amy Steigerwald. Terrific conversation today. Thanks very much for being with us. I'm Bill Nygut. As I said, we will be back with you on Monday at 2, Tuesday at 2. John Ward, the author of Camelot's End, a new book about the battle between Edward Kennedy and Jimmy Carter for the 1980 Democratic presidential nomination, will join us for the hour. His book is really interesting. The Carter people hate it already. We will talk about it on Tuesday. In the meantime, we'll see you as soon as possible, Monday at 2.